This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Elihu Smith, who is the priest at the Prairie Zen Center. And we're going to be talking about hate and violence in religious traditions. Welcome, Elihu.
Thank you.
Now, your full name, including your Buddhist name, is Elihu Genmyo Smith?
Yes.
And tell me about Genmyo.
Genmyo literally means mysterious, subtle, and it's the Japanese pronunciation of certain characters that are Chinese or Japanese characters, and it's one of the names I received when I took Buddhist precepts. So it's a form of ordination, taking the precepts, and I had lay ordination and then what we call clerical ordination. It's Sino-Japanese, we call it jukai, or receiving or taking the precepts, and there's two different forms of it.
Now, Elihu is also a somewhat unusual name. Tell us about that.
Well, that's my given name. It literally means, if one knows the Hebrew Bible, it means God, my God, and it's a familial name in the sense that I was named after a grandfather who had that name.
I see. And Smith, we don't need to talk about. But where are you from?
I was born and grew up in New York City.
Now, many people in this country, when they meet someone who's a Buddhist, think, oh, well, they must have come from Asia. Tell us how you became a Buddhist.
Well, in my 20s, let me start, actually, let's back up. I was born and grew up in an Orthodox Hasidic family, it's a Jewish family, and at a certain point in life, somewhere in my early 20s, I left that tradition in the sense that I ceased practicing it as a religious tradition. And several years after that, I was attracted towards two meditation practices. And I explored different forms of meditation practices. And at a certain point, I found myself resonating with a Zen Buddhist tradition.
I see.
And began practicing formal meditation in 71 and became affiliated with a Zen temple in New York in 74.
Did you encounter Zen Buddhism through reading or through meeting practitioners?
Well, actually, I encountered it through reading and through having a roommate who actually, he and I had grown up together, known each other as children, and then later lived together while we were in school. And he was studying various Japanese arts, and he introduced me to it. And interestingly enough, at that time, I was practicing Hindu-based meditation traditions, and I, in a sense, introduced him to that, and he became a swami in a Hindu tradition. And from that, I met several Buddhist and Zen teachers in the early 70s in New York, which was a hotbed. I met people like Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche and Soa Nakagawa Roshi, and I could name other names, but many people who were coming through New York, and I felt a connection to certain teachers and began practicing formally with them, going to a Zen temple and doing retreats and so on and so forth.
Now, it seems like many people of your generation were exploring different religious alternatives during mm-hmm. those years. How did your family, since you said you were raised in a Orthodox Jewish Hasidic family, how did they react to your taking this different path?
Well, let me backtrack even further. I had a break with my family, even in just moving out and not following the Hasidic tradition. Forget about everything else. What I was doing was anathema to them, and there was a major break just over that. And after that, everything just... We have a certain amount of connection, but it's very limited. So the details after that are secondary. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that I wasn't following the Hasidic and the Orthodox tradition that was the issue.
Now, since our topic for today that you suggested, and I was delighted to include in the list of things we'd be doing this month, is hate and violence in religious traditions. In your own family, have you experienced, if not violence, at least, maybe hate is the appropriate word. I don't know.
We could say hate. We could say denigration of others. And in a sense, this is the major point. We're sort of coming at it from another side. But there's a sense where when one feels that your religious tradition is right, there's often a poison in that if we also have as part of that feeling that others are wrong. And it's a major issue. And one of the ways that helps me think about it is that in the Buddhist tradition, and we have precepts, and one of the precepts is, I would state it as, not praising self and degrading others.
So this is sort of like a teaching, almost a commandment that one is not supposed to praise oneself, one is not supposed to degrade others?
Refrain from praising yourself and degrading others, or vowing to not elevate myself and put down others. Now, in a sense, in the Buddhist tradition, it's easy to see this because the issue in Buddhist practice and Zen practice is always this self-centeredness and self-attachment. And of course, this is that in other religious traditions as well. It's stated in different ways, but this is, I think, a basic theme. If I say it in another way, I think it's an issue in all religious traditions, given that religious traditions in one way are enabling one to whether we call it salvation or liberation or submission or harmony, are aiming towards that area of functioning to encourage that and to support that. And yet, somehow, there's this thing that slips in when we denigrate others by elevating ourselves, which then is almost a poison in the brew or a worm in the apple by saying that I'm right. Do I also have to say that someone else is wrong? Or can I say that I'm right and my being right doesn't take away from someone else being right?
Now, I'm curious, coming as you have from an Orthodox Jewish tradition to Zen Buddhism, mm-hmm. do you see that this Buddhist precept, since you've chosen this personally,
yes.
to not only follow but to be a priest and, uh-huh. and to encourage others in following mm-hmm. this precept, do you see this as an improvement over what's in the Jewish Torah about one's supposed to love your neighbor?
Let me say it differently. It's not a matter of improvement. It's a matter of seeing what's appropriate for as a religious practice for me, and what enables me to, if I say, to live as full a life as who I am. Now, there are things, if we want to make that comparison, there are things about my religious upbringing that I've come to appreciate much more because of my Zen practice. Mm. And for whatever reasons, I wasn't able to appreciate them then, or, and this is the more significant, or there were issues in the way they were taught, the way I was living, my family traditions, that made it impossible for me to get to that point. And This, in a sense, if I could come back to it, this is touches on what I see in, I would say, religious practices have two aspects. One aspect is the aspect of enabling and supporting one to be, if you want to say, in touch with the absolute, if you want to say, intrinsic, be what one intrinsically is, if to fulfill one's soul. We could use all sorts of words. We could use the words I used before, liberation, salvation, in harmony, submit to the will of God. All different traditions use different words. That's one aspect. But the other aspect of religious traditions is enable one to practice with or handle or deal with self-centered habits that come up. We could call them ego. You can call them evil inclinations. Different religious traditions have different ways of talking about them. But that's something that has to be dealt with, those habits of body-mind that get us in trouble. In Buddhist tradition, we talk about them as the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance.
Let me just reintroduce our guest today here for a moment, if I may, Elihu. We're talking with a priest from the Prairie Zen Center, Elihu Smith, Elihu Genmyo Smith, and we're talking about hate and violence in religious traditions. And one thing I love about this format of a program is we have time, we have a full hour to talk about it, and we also have an opportunity for listeners to join in the conversation. So if you're listening and would like to ask our guest, Elihu Smith, a question or make a comment or disagree, that's fine. Do give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. The call letters of the station, of course. In Champaign-Urbana, to make it easy for you, where there are several local lines, you can access by punching in 333-9455. And I see we have a caller waiting already on our toll-free line, line number 4. You're on the air with our guest, Elihu Smith. Go ahead. Yes, line number 4. Are you there? Well, we seem to not have a connection. Can you hear me on line number 4?
Me?
Yes, that's you.
Go right ahead. A timely and important topic. Two questions, please. First of all, though I come from a Christian tradition, it seems to me that the Buddhist tradition has had far less violence associated with it than the Christian tradition or other religious traditions. Could your guest comment?
I would agree with you. There is less violence, or this historically seems to be, but nevertheless, there are, have been, and continue to be times when what I would call self-centeredness, whether it's in terms of the individual or in terms of nationalism or other ideologies, gets mixed in with the Buddhist tradition. And then people can even use the Buddhism to justify supporting those sorts of behaviors. But I agree with you for the most part that Buddhism is a religion of nonviolence. As I said, greed, anger, and ignorance are seen as poisons, which the tradition is always enabling one to work directly with, so as, because that's the causes of suffering. And if we say anything, Buddhism is about suffering, the cause of suffering, an end to suffering, and a way to the end. So,
caller, if I could just jump in here for a second. I happen to come from a Christian tradition, and I know that many Christian nations have been leaders in violence, and I've even written publicly about that. But let me just raise a couple questions. Thailand's a Buddhist, predominantly Buddhist country. They just had a military coup there last week. China and Japan, predominantly Buddhist. Would you say their history has been violence-free? Are you still there, Colin?
Yes. I realize they aren't. They aren't. But I guess when you look at the colonial powers in World War I and World War II were fought by predominantly Christian nations, it seems like the scale of violence is much greater among professing Christian.
Unfortunately, the history of Japan during World War II is an atrocious one, and the failure of the Buddhist traditions to challenge that, in fact, just the opposite, some Buddhist sects and groups supported the government and mixed up their Buddhist practice with Japanese nationalism. It's quite unfortunate. So there's this self-centeredness that we as members of the same, as one of my teachers would say, nose-hole society, meaning all us humans, have this tendency. And the question is, do we work with it? Can we see it? Or are we blinded by it and therefore do things that are truly problematic? Nevertheless, at the same time, I will agree with you that there are very few examples that you could even vaguely call religious wars in Buddhist tradition.
Mm-hmm. And you had a second question,
yes.
I think.
I'll take my answer off the air. It seems like religious values, religious violence is, religious wars are more intense than other kind of violence or wars. Could you comment, please? Thank you very much.
I suppose part of the more intense aspect is related to the fact that the connection to religion is a more intense connection, and therefore there's more of what it is to be human and the human energies that are brought to bear in religious wars. It's unfortunate because what it does is it blinds us to what the consequences of what we're doing is.
And it really gets back to one of the first points you made in this hour, that there's such a tendency, if you think you have the only truth and everyone else is wrong, mm-hmm. that they automatically start slipping down in value.
Yes, yes. And that is the a major point where we denigrate others and we don't see it sometimes. Sometimes it's in simple things and sometimes it's more elaborate. There are all sorts of examples in every tradition where even simple words, for instance, if I could just bring up, even let us say when Christians use a phrase Old Testament to talk about the Hebrew Bible, there's an implicit denigration there, which often isn't even noticed because it's just the way people have always referred to it who are brought up in certain Christian traditions. But there is something like that. That's the same in Buddhist traditions. Some Buddhist traditions refer to others as Hinayana, meaning small vehicle, whereas they refer to themselves as Mahayana, big vehicle. There's a certain denigration there, and therefore one has to be careful. And it works on both, in all sides. It works in many traditions. And I could cite many examples, but there's sort of an interesting point is that those within the tradition often are the last to see it. It takes someone from outside the religion to see, or the outside the tradition to see it, and yet at the same time, it's not for those outside the tradition to correct it, so to speak, because it's only from within, those within the tradition, that can begin to work on what it is that's informing those minor or not so minor actions, whether it's using certain words to refer to other ones or killing people, but making sure you baptize them before you kill them so that their soul, eternal soul, is saved.
I didn't know Buddhists baptized, but we'll need
no,
to
no,
talk
I'm
about
not
that.
Talking about Buddhists.
subtle denigration.
but actually, there are forms similar to baptism in Buddhism, and actually, you can even do that. It's when someone is dying or dead.
We have another caller waiting on line one. There are several lines open, though, if others would like to speak with our guest, Elihu Smith, from the Zen Buddhist tradition. Do give us a call, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana area. Outside of that, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, My heritage is I'm a woman, obviously, and about 7 years old. There were three boys. One boy called up and asked me, I'm thinking about being a Zen Buddhist. What's that all about? Not wanting to be guilty of the sin of ignorance, I will hang up and listen to your explanation. What should I tell him?
If I can restate the question as I understand it, you asked, what is Zen Buddhism about? In one sense, it's simply being exactly as we are. And in being as we are, we discover that we're not limited to our small, if I use that kind of phrase, ideas of my self-centeredness, but that this whole life that we encounter all the time is exactly ourself. When we encounter other people, we're encountering ourself. When we encounter the trees and the breeze, we're encountering our own voice, our own body movement, our own breath. So in one sense, Zen is being present, being ordinary. But in a more deeper sense, if I say it, it's a way to work with those self-centered habits that keep us from being ourselves and which also perpetuate suffering and harm. So one way to work with it, or one aspect of working with it, is what we call Zen meditation or Zen sitting, Zazen. Even the word meditation is not quite right. So it's practices, you can call them religious practices, that enable us and support us in being present, in being this simple body-mind functioning that we are, and manifesting wisdom and compassion.
Let me follow up on that caller's question about the nature of Zen Buddhism. You talked about Zen teachings as being nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any permissions within Buddhism, within Zen Buddhism, to defend oneself, for a nation to defend oneself, for a
yes.
group of people who might be oppressed uh-huh. to rise up in revolution?
Let me say that in Buddhist tradition is not a pacifistic, it's a nonviolent tradition. Now, there are different ways to interpret that, but in the Buddhist canon, in Buddhist canon writings, there are discussions of how to relate to war. Now, of course, this is different if one is a monk or has taken certain precepts, but there are, quote, you might say, righteous versus unrighteous wars, defensive. But even in wars where one is being defensive, there are cautions not to resort to unnecessary acts of cruelty or violence, even towards the defeated, not to harm innocents, and even to pardon those who are defeated. Now, at the same time, I can talk about texts where the Buddha sat in the way of an army that was coming to attack his clansmen, if I say it in that way, and he just sat there. He did that once, and because in the tradition in India at that time was that if that happens, the army would turn back, the army turned back. And that happened three times. And after three times, when the army came the fourth time, he didn't do it any longer. And what happened was his clansmen, his family and extended family were all wiped out. So there's different aspects to it.
So in that example, is that the Buddhist, the followers of Buddha look to that example as how they should live?
Well, there's a number of different examples, or I should say exemplars, that people refer back to. For instance, there were Buddhist monks in Korea who fought against the Japanese, in China, who didn't fight, but who certainly supported the troops when the Japanese were invading. It's not very simple, but, as I said, it's a tradition that emphasizes nonviolence. Now, there's a difference between someone who's a Buddhist who does X, Y, and Z, and from the Buddhist tradition doing X, Y, and Z. And I think that's a major problem we have in talking about things. We often mix up adjectives and nouns. So an adjective someone was a Christian murderer.
Or an Islamic fascist.
Or an Islamic fascist. Now, one could be a fascist who happens to be an Islamic or Muslim, and who even uses Islam to justify their fascist behavior. But if we mix that up and we don't see that the word Islamic is being used as a adjective, but instead we take it as a noun, then it becomes accusing Islam of being fascistic.
And it's interesting that in recent times we've had examples of the current administration liking to use that phrase, Islamic fascist, and I never recall people calling Mussolini or Hitler Christian fascists.
Yeah, it is interesting. Since you brought up Hitler, there was movement in Nazi Germany for certain Christian churches at the behest of the Nazi Party and the German state to change the Christian Bible, to remove all remnants of Judaism, both in terms of Jesus and in terms of the Hebrew Bible or anything else. Now, you might say that those people were Christian Nazis because this was the Christian church who was saying we are manifesting Nazism as our form of Christianity. But it's, again, there's a problem of getting mixed up. And as I said, it's a problem of adjectives and nouns and us humans mixing it up together and not seeing that what we're doing.
Fortunately, in that example you just raised, there were also members of the German Christian Church like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth and others who opposed Hitler and did that also in the name of Christianity.
Right.
Well, we have another caller waiting on line number 4. Let's go to our toll-free line. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to start with just a question, and that is in any religion that you can think of as a mainstream religion in the world, do most of them preach peace? The ones that I'm aware of, most of them are based on peace, joy, kind of coming together, community. Is this true?
Well, that's the point that I made early on, that there's, I think there's two aspects. There is that aspect, but there's also an aspect where we do what's called I'm right, and if I'm right, you're wrong. So
an in-group, out-group type of mentality.
And not seeing it and having a hard time being able to say, I'm right and you are also right.
Sure.
See, and if we can start seeing where we are denigrating others and even where we are raising ourselves up is a way of denigrating others, then we can begin getting at what I would call a poison that otherwise has all sorts of consequences, maybe not just for us, because we're, whatever you want to say, nonviolent, we're generous, compassionate, loving, but maybe other people will take this aspect of the tradition and turn it into a way of mistreating others. For instance, let's even talk about in some traditions, there's evangelizing as a tradition, going out and attempting to bring one's tradition to another. Now, in one sense, you could say, would that's being done because they feel that if without this, people will suffer lack in salvation. They will suffer after death. Whatever other construct and explanation you have, that so it's a compassionate act. But on the other hand, it's also an act where you denigrate who and what the other person is right now, and you say the way your tradition is bad, is wrong, and so on and so forth. And without seeing that, you can get caught in one way or the other. And then you see all sorts of missionary activities that are part of colonizing, a part of oppression, a part of enslavement.
Well, then I guess what the question that you have to really think about then, to me at least, is that you mentioned this, the poison, this kind of idea that a leader or someone is able to persuade people through religion that other people are wrong and that they have a certain moral authority over these other people. And so I guess then if no religion in the actual scripture or in the basis of the religion preaches any kind of moral authority or you're in the in-group and others are in the out-group, then you have to question the motives of the leaders. And then I would say that all the violence that would have to come from religion would have to come from these leaders who are using religion to persuade massive amounts of people to back their own political agendas. Would you see that to be true?
No. It's not. It's in the religious texts and traditions that you have both of those aspects. I don't think you just it is, of course, the leaders who emphasize one or emphasize another or who challenge one and or another. But I think many religious texts and traditions have this other aspect in them. Sometimes it's very subtle and it's overemphasized at certain times, and sometimes it's more overt. Sometimes it's also understandable. For instance, you could say that in early Christianity, it was important for Christians to separate themselves from their Jewish roots in order to develop the Christian tradition. But you can also say that as that continued and became solidified, that became a justification for anti-Semitism. You can say the same within Buddhist tradition. You could say the same in terms of Islam, in terms of Islam differentiating itself and justifying itself as coming to add something to the Christian and Jewish teachings. And yet you can also see how at a certain point that becomes a way of denigrating Christianity and Judaism and those roots of Islam. I could go on further, but let's stop at that.
Would you say that then the complacency of the people of following, does that affect in any way kind of, I mean, if you said in some religions it's mentioned more subtly and in others it's more overt, it's more on the surface, it's more apparent. Mm-hmm. Is it then the complacency of the congregation or the groups of people that follow how the leaders of these groups, how they make it apparent in the religion?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Appreciate very much your call. We have another caller waiting. Before I get to that, let me give the numbers again for others who'd like to join the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. For those outside Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455. WILL AM 580 is a radio service of the College of Communication at the University of Illinois. You're listening to Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. We're about halfway through this program where we're discussing hate and violence in religious traditions with a Zen Buddhist priest, Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign. Do encourage listeners to join us. I might mention that this program is supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. Coming up at the Y this week are some fascinating programs where you can come and hear a speaker talk on environmental issues on Friday. Last Friday we had a wonderful talk by Professor Zuza Gila from the University of Illinois Sociology Department this coming Friday, How Corporate Campaigning Can Save the World. Rainforest Action Network will be leading giving the talk, and there'll be a chance for comments and questions from the audience. It's a free lecture this Friday at the Y, the 29th of September at noon. If you'd like to make reservations for lunch, do call the Y, 337-1500. Wonderful Thai food from the Y Eatery is available very inexpensively. You may also bring your lunch or simply come and listen to the lecture. The following Friday, continuing our series on the environment, ecological design as the essence of sustainability with Katrin Klingenberg from the Ecological Construction Lab. So those are the next two Fridays, part of the Friday Forum series. This Tuesday at the Y at noon, we have some wonderful music. Nathaniel Banks and friends will be providing, will be playing and talking about jazz music as the expression of a people, how African Americans have contributed to American music from New Orleans jazz all the way to the post-bop generation. So come and hear some great music free at the Y at noon this coming Tuesday. That's September 26th. Nathaniel Banks and friends playing music and talking about it. So those are some things coming up soon. And I might just mention that Irfan Ahmed will be giving a lecture, not at the Y, but it's one that we certainly would want people listening to this program to know about, on Tuesday, October 3rd, also at noon, The Role of Muslim Americans in Winning Hearts and Minds Globally. That will be at the Foreign Language Building on campus at noon, Tuesday, October 3rd, Professor Irfan Ahmed. Elihu, you had an announcement to make?
Well, it's not an announcement. I wanted to sort of bring up what I would call, this is a takeoff on an old joke.
And all right.
Let's start. There's this wise man and followers of various religions, well, in this case, let us say Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, come to him, and the Christian brings him the Christian Bible, the New Testament, and says, oh, look at this. It shows how Christianity is the true, wonderful religion. And he says, oh, yes, you're right. And then the Jew comes in, but he says, look, here's the Hebrew Bible, and it shows how Judaism is the word of God and so on and so forth. And he says, you're right. And then the Muslim comes to him and says, and shows him the Quran and says, look, here, there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, and so on and so forth. It's right here in the Quran. And he says, you're right. And then someone standing next to him says, you know, you said to all three of those that they're each right. How could that be? They can't all be right. And he says, you're right. Now, in a sense, that's the koan, if I put it in Zen terms, for us. Can we be right, and can others be right at the same time? Can others be right without taking away from our right, being right? There was an interesting book that I noticed a university professor here at U of I recently put out, Professor Feinberg, it's called For Goodness Sake, Religious Schools and Education in Democratic Citizenry. And in it, he has an interesting phrase where he talks about the right of chauvinism, where, if I'll quote from this article, he says, I have a right to believe my religion is the best religion in the world, but I also believe that you have the right to believe that your religion is the best religion in the world. We have a difficulty with, as I said, this precept that I spoke of, the praising self and degrading others, because we separate self and other. And that's really what this precept is connected to. In Buddhist tradition, when we have these precepts, there's various verses or poems that are connected with this. And there's a set of verses with these precepts called the One Mind verse. And if I could just read that, it goes, "Self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the undifferentiated teaching," or it says Dharma, but Dharma means teaching, "not speaking of self and other is called the precept of refraining from praising yourself and degrading others."
How can you, following up on that reading, how can you have made the choice to be a Zen Buddhist and left your family religious tradition behind, in a sense, and you have all these others that you've, other religious possibilities that you've studied, that you've met people who are very good people, who are also peaceful, are also self-actuated and helping other folks and living model ethical lives. How can you have made a choice and value what others have chosen and yet not feel it's arbitrary?
Well, let's put it a different way, because you made certain statements there that aren't quite accurate. When you say left behind, in a sense, I don't see it as left behind, but rather continued unfolding. As I said, in many ways, I don't find my Zen practice needs to exclude anything else. And it certainly doesn't exclude my Jewish tradition and background. And as I said, I appreciate all the more. For me, it's a matter of what resonates with me. How can I resonate in this intimacy that is life? That's really what, as I see it, as I practice it, Zen or Buddhist practice is about. It's manifesting this life that we are. And we each do it in our own particular way, in the forms that, for whatever reasons, come together as we are. I, for instance, I don't have any musical abilities. And so that isn't going to be a form that I manifest who and what my life is. But that doesn't take away from someone else manifesting their practice and their life in their music, in their expression and resonating of that. Now, if I say the only way to do it is my way, then we have difficulties. And that's a difficulty in various orthodoxies as well. In other words, saying that only my way of practicing our tradition, and it becomes a problem where orthodoxies enforce that on their co-religionists. The only way to be a good Jew, Muslim, Buddhist, Christian is to do it my way. And we have, unfortunately, this long history in all the various traditions where people punish, oppress, commit hate and violence towards their co-religionists over what's the correct way to do, to act. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't rules, but
when two Buddhist, predominantly Buddhist countries like Japan and Korea have had so many problems over the years, is that result partially because of Buddhism, or is it in spite of Buddhism?
I would say in spite of. If you actually look at Buddhist tradition in Japan came originally from Korea in about the year, somewhere in the 6th century, and for several centuries afterwards. Nevertheless, Korea and Japan have a long history of national conflicts. So what happens is that the nationalism, the self-identification, or what I would call the transformed self, which becomes identification with some group of, whether it's a nation or something else, justifies the kind of violence towards the non-group, the kind of subjugation. And we're blinded to this life that we are, that we all share.
The connection between religious traditions and nationalism. You've talked about several times. Is it a particular temptation for followers of a particular religious tradition if the nation they belong to becomes extremely powerful?
I think it's a temptation for all humans in every direction. In a sense, religion is a counterweight, if I say it in that way, to these human self-centered temptations. I sometimes talk about them as habits of body-mind. We could talk about them in Buddhism as the three poisons. It's the things that keep suffering going in our world from
And the three poisons are greed,
anger, and ignorance. Ignorance meaning delusion about self and others, me and not me.
People who know a little bit about Zen Buddhism, and maybe not a whole lot, often accuse practitioners, followers of Zen Buddhism, of not being angry enough at injustice, at being willing to live a life of quietism, meditation, peace, but not caring enough for people who are really suffering. How do you respond to that?
Well, what one does is a matter of choice and proclivities. So some people have a interest in social action, and others, that isn't their, if I use the word, cup of tea. To argue that they ought to is, again, saying that my way is the way everyone else should be. This is the only right way. But the other part is, if you get angry, in a way, that poisons what you do often. I see all sorts of hatred being justified on the right, on the left, in the internet. You see all sorts of hatred being justified for political reasons because we're right and they're wrong, whether it's anti-Bush, whether it's homophobia, whether it's about abortion, women's rights. You could go on in all directions. People justify, because of their political position, the hatred, which is the poison, which is what we're talking about. We're talking about hate and violence justified on the basis of a religious tradition, which is about liberation and salvation. And it's, in a sense, inherently contradictory. Yes, Buddhist tradition, in a sense, focuses on the small and local in some ways. But the small and local is always connected to the big, the whole universe. See, so when we take care of even meeting with one other person, we're meeting with the whole of the universe is there. See, in Buddhist tradition, we don't hold on to those distinctions of self and universe as too different. Or if we do, that becomes a problem. So we have to be able to go both directions to see that the whole universe is right here, and at the same time to see that everything we encounter in the universe is just myself. It's not something other than me, and therefore I don't have any connection with it.
We're down to about our last 10 minutes of Keeping the Faith this Sunday afternoon. This is a live program. It is a call-in program. If you have comments or questions for our guest, Elihu Smith, please give us a ring. 333-9455 is the local number. 1-800-222-9455 is available toll-free for long-distance calls. And that's true even for listeners on the Internet anywhere in the continental U.S. If you're listening on your computer to this program, do give us a call. Let's go to a local line. Let's see. I guess we have two up. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes. I am a Christian, and I've been following, and I know just a little bit about the Hindu religion, if indeed it can be called a religion. But the question I have is this question, and because I posed it of my Christian, Muslim, and Judaic friends. Is there an absolute moral wrong that all religions, indeed all people, could agree to. For example, killing of children is always wrong. Killing of anybody is always wrong. And I would like to ask that question, and I'll hang up and see what the response is. Thank you.
I'm not sure what the word wrong means to the questioner, because I would say that all sorts of killing has consequences which are harmful, which perpetuate suffering. And killing of children, killing of animals, killing of all sorts, even killing of others by speaking in certain ways to them. That's another form of violence. In Buddhist tradition, we have, if we concentrate the precepts, we talk about the first precept being non-harming. Non-harming means non-killing, but non-harming in all sorts of other ways. And non-harming not just humans, but all sorts of other beings. Non-harming even the environment. So, of course, if you ask, should I do that, I would say, no, don't do it. Because there are harmful consequences for you, for others. And in fact, it rips apart this very life that we are. It perpetuates suffering. So in that sense, I would say, at least from the Buddhist tradition, it doesn't make a difference. But at the same time, we could see all sorts of traditions justify killing. They also have rules that say, well, killing in A, B, C is fine. A meaning whether it's a war, whether this person has done certain things that justify killing them, whether this person is of a group, a tradition that we justify killing them, and we go on from that. So,
just to illustrate some of the difficulties with making these kind of broad moral statements, you suggested perhaps it's always wrong to kill children, but what if one's a policeman called to a school where a child has killed three of his classmates and a teacher and standing there with a gun ready to shoot someone else? Is it then morally justified? Is it the right thing to do to kill that murderer? But that's just an example of some of the difficulties. We have another caller waiting who may even add to the difficulties. Line number four, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, I would like to ask you, with your own particular slant on being a Buddhist priest, due to your unique background, as an Orthodox Jew, what would your advice be to the world as we try and approach, difficulties with the different countries and all the conflicts in the world? I mean, it just seems like we're heading into another phase of extraordinary conflict, or the potential for extraordinary world conflict, God forbid World War III. But what would your slant be? What would you tell President Bush and all the world leaders if you could address the United Nations?
That's a big question and a big responsibility. But if I were to say something simple, it was be kind, be compassionate, listen to what others have to say, and put yourself in their place, and then go from there. And what is most needed is to be able to hear both what we have to say and what others have to say. And then to be able to see others as ourself, and also to see ourself connected to all the others.
Did you want a follow-up, caller?
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously, I think a lot of, speaking theoretically, I think a lot of Jews, Christians, a lot of different religions would say, sitting all at the table, that they would like to agree with that. But when it comes down to somebody, like example, if called to war, and I'm totally against war, but if called to war as far as in true self-defense, I don't mean going to Iraq. I mean if somebody invades our country or bombs our shores, what would the response be with regards to your stance on things?
Well, as I've said, the Buddhist tradition does have defensive wars, does have fighting in response to those sorts of situations. And then it becomes a question, at what point does that, so to speak, kick in? Is it when the other person has attacked you once, the other person says that they're going to attack you, they brandish missiles and then say, if you don't do A and B? And this becomes the issue that our political leaders need to deal with wisdom, but at the same time with compassion. So broad generalities are very difficult. Nevertheless, I think a precept of non-harming, a precept that encourages us to see our own greed and anger and our own delusions or misunderstandings, is one that it will give us guidance to take the next step.
I want to thank that caller and all of our other callers for making this a very interesting program. And, of course, to our guest, Elihu Smith, who is the priest at the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign. For people who'd like more information about Buddhism, how may they learn?
Well, if you want information about the Prairie Zen Center, look at our website, www.prairiezen.org.
Thank you very much. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week I'll be traveling, but Don Nolan will be our guest host, and he'll be interviewing Tammy Tumnell from a woman's fund, a woman's place that provides safety for women in violent situations. On October 8, I'll be back behind the microphone interviewing a couple via telephone from Australia about nonviolent communication. I'll be talking with Rich and Maria McGuire about nonviolent communication. On October 15, our guest on Keeping the Faith, our guests will be Carol Ammons and Brian Dalinar, and we'll be talking about the criminal justice system or the criminal injustice system. Matt Bolton will be our guest from Andover Newton Theological Seminary, talking about the American traditional music use in Christian worship. That's Sweet the Sound. We'll be talking and hearing some music from that recent CD on October 22nd. Books for Prisoners with Sandra Otten will be our topic for the 29th of October. I remind people to come to the Y this Tuesday noon for some jazz with Nathaniel Banks, and on Friday noon for the Next Friday Forum lecture and discussion on topics of the environment. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
One recent top-selling song was by rapper Kanye West, but it wasn't hardcore hip-hop. It was a gospel song called Jesus Walks. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, the rebirth of gospel music. We'll look at where gospel came from and where it's going. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy early in the evening, then clearing. The low in the mid-40s with northwest winds around 10 miles per hour early, then becoming light. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high around 70 degrees and west winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s and light winds.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.